I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it.
Welcome back to part 3 of 4 with Rabbi Adlerstein, and he continues to give an Orthodox point of view. And we start off with the discussion of the Bible codes, which I thought he would be a proponent of because it's kind of impressive proof that the Torah is true, but maybe not. He had a strong reaction.
Right. I think that's a horrible argument. Say, hey, look at this. You got the Bible codes. What a wonderful piece of bait to throw out to people. My job isn't to bait people. It shouldn't be. If I ever fall into that, then I'm a disgrace to my religion. My job is to represent the truth of Hashem's Torah, of God's Torah. You can't build truth with falsity. I believe firmly that there are codes that are built into the Bible. I don't believe that what is currently going around as scientifically proven codes are the codes that have validity. If you're going to call something science, then they have to match scientific criteria, and they don't. There is just far too much wiggle room in the design of the experiment to prove the thesis. You've got to understand that in a religion as complex as ours, there are close to an infinite number of associations that are going to look powerful and meaningful, because there's so many combinations of thoughts and words that do run together and form clusters of intelligible thought. And you're dealing with a number of combinations that is also infinite. By the laws of statistics, if you didn't come up with lots and lots of examples of it, there would be something wrong. The key is to come up with a well-designed scientific experiment in which you can sort of predict in advance what you're going to come up with and then see if the hypothesis can be proven. So they're still quibbling about one particular experiment done 10 years ago where people who I trust in the scientific world, including a group of 50 formidable mathematicians, a good number of whom are Orthodox Jews, have looked at the statistical design and see nothing to it. So again, I don't want anybody to make any mistakes. I believe that the Torah comes from God and that God put lots of subliminal things in there that still have to be discovered. But if you're going to call something scientific, then you better deliver, because I'm not interested in selling Torah by effective snake oil.
Okay, we switch gears and I ask him about the story of Adam and Eve and whether he thinks it's literal or metaphorical.
The issue of metaphor in the Bible is more complex than most traditional Jews know. Personally, I don't have any great reason to regard anything in Genesis as metaphorical. But I will admit that there were giants of Jewish thought hundreds of years ago, before any of this became an issue, you know, with modern science, who did treat certain passages metaphorically. Abarbanel, the great leader of Spanish Jewry at the time of the expulsion from Spain, in his treatment of the first couple of chapters of Genesis, actually does an inventory of those who thought the Garden of Eden was a metaphor, Adam and Eve were a metaphor, the serpent was a metaphor. There are certain sections of the Torah where you do find great thinkers who thought them metaphoric, usually all the way at the beginning of Genesis. By the time you get to things like the flood, or certainly the lives of the patriarchs, to the best of my knowledge, you don't have anybody who call them the metaphors. So I'm not a great fan of treating them metaphorically, but I'm not going to deny that the religion doesn't stand or fall on the basis of it either. I think it does stand and fall on certain key events in history, like the Exodus from Egypt and Sinai.
Okay, we switch gears once again, and the topic goes to tattooing. Why are tattoos frowned upon?
What is the reason why tattoos are frowned upon? Well, if you believe that Jews are enlightened through the course of history, I think we have we know today far better than they did 50 years ago why tattoos are frowned upon, and that's because Britney wears them. Other than that, going this whole route is fraught with danger. We don't know the reasons for practically anything in the Torah. And the beginning of any conversation about why has to be, why has nothing to do with the fact that we observe. The starting point is that we believe in God like a loving father, especially in the case of a father who has nothing to gain by his children complying. We trust in God's wisdom and God's goodness, that anything that he's asked us to do is for our own good, and we are the ones who are enriched or diminished by practicing or not practicing. That said, there is indeed a tradition going back many, many hundreds of years of people who have looked into mitzvos, commandments, one by one, to see what kind of lessons we could derive from them. Tattoos. The thought that comes to mind is that of the 19th century German thinker, who is more relevant today than when he wrote, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, the great rejuvenator of Orthodox Judaism in Frankfurt, Germany, who sees tattooing as a form of think what Rosham Shofalher says is that tattooing is too close to comfort with the idea of branding, of people putting themselves in the service of other things, whether they're deities or other, which is such a common practice for the Torah band. But I don't want to say that without checking.
He wasn't quite sure of his memory, so he wanted to check with a chumash in the book of Hirsch. Commentary, Hirsch Chumash, tried to say that 10 times fast, but we didn't have one at hand, so he didn't want to commit to that answer. I like the fact that he's able to admit when he's not sure of an answer. But I added another stipulation, which is, what if a potential convert comes with a tattoo? How does the Beit Din react to that?
What if a Gentile comes and wants to convert with a tattoo? What if a Jew who wasn't observant had a tattoo and now wants to upgrade his performance? The prohibition is having the tattoo done. It's the inscribing, it's not keeping it. There's no prohibition whatsoever in maintaining the tattoo. The only reason why somebody would want to remove it is because of the embarrassment. Because every time the tattoo shows, he's sort of like, why does he have that? Where is this guy coming from? But there's no problem in people with tattoos coming back to traditional Jewish life. I'd say people who spent years speaking Lashon Hara, speaking evilly about others, have a much more serious a burden that they have to unburden themselves of, because where a particular kind of social transgression becomes part of your daily conduct, doesn't matter whether you were Jewish or not Jewish before, that becomes part of your personality, and that's much harder to shake. I would much prefer that a person came with a tattoo and a clean record on proper speech than somebody came without a tattoo on his body and was a gossip columnist.
And what about a beard? There are prohibitions against cutting one's beard.
There are at least two separate prohibitions in the Torah having to do with cutting facial hair. One has to do with rounding off a certain part of the skull, and that means that any part of the head, basically in this area around the temples and then around the back, can't be cut by any means. And then there are about five areas that are called the corners of the head. That's the way it's described in the Bible. And if you ever take a look at a skull, you'd be surprised to see that what we see is nice and round really is very angular. There are literally corners, places where bones come to almost 90 degree angles. In those places, the beard, according to halakha, is not supposed to be destroyed. It's a different verb used by the Torah. So what is prohibited is only the kind of close to the skin cutting that is done by a straight edge, by a razor, which is why many Jews will use an electric shaver, which cuts with a snipping action. If you look in the Bible, you'll see that the two prohibitions about cutting here and cutting there actually have a different verb. And halachically, according to the oral law, it makes all the difference in the world. So the reason why you'll see many Jews with beards is because, you know, like the old joke about two Jews, three opinions, in halachic matters as well, they're often different opinions, so that we're not quite sure where those five areas are. So to be on the safe side, people generally don't shave there at all, at least not with a straight edge.
So is that why some people have very long peos or side curls?
Peos, the corners of the head, not the corners of the beard. Two separate prohibitions, should not be cut. You fulfill that mitzvah simply by not cutting the hair in this band down below a certain level. The practice of growing them long and twirling them and comes really from both Kabbalistic sources and from non-Kabbalistic sources, in that any time God gives us any commandment, we like to beautify it or adorn it or accentuate it. So while there's no question that you don't need to grow things 47 feet long that you then curl up in order to fulfill the mitzvah, even if you just don't cut it down to very close to the skin, you fulfill the mitzvah. There was a practice in many parts of the Jewish world, in Eastern Europe, in Yemen, really disparate parts of the Jewish world. If God gives us a mitzvah like this, we want to be proud of it and accentuate it. So they would deliberately grow the hair there to a much longer length than is actually halachically required. It's a fine custom.
I asked him about the explanation I had heard for the payas, the side curls, from someone in the Happy Minyan in Los Angeles, that it connects the head to the heart.
It's in Kabbalistic or soft Kabbalistic. Remember, the Jewish mysticism is different from other systems of mysticism in that it wasn't the realm just for the mystic. Chassidus, the Hasidic movement in particular, is a way of distilling some of the beauty of Kabbalistic tradition, bringing it down to the level of the layman. So some of the works referenced probably by people at the Happy Minyan are in the Kabbalah soft arena.
Well, since he brought up the topic of Hasidim, or Hasidut, or Hasidus, I asked him about the opponents of that philosophy.
Mitnagdim were those hundreds of years ago who opposed the changes of Hasidut, of Hasidism. I'm not sure whether today there are true Hasidim or true Mitnagdim. So I'm not going to typify myself. I'd say if there were such a continuum, I am more on the non-Hasidic side than the Hasidic side. But one of the reasons why I am is so that I can enjoy to a greater extent Hasidic literature. Sounds ironic. What I mean by that is that people who are often into a particular variety or brand of Hasidut specialize in the literature of their movement. While today it's so firmly recognized by the rest of the Jewish world, the beauty of much of Hasidic thought, that if you look at my library, you'll see the representative works of 20 groups of Hasidim. So I can be an equal opportunity student of different varieties of thought and still not have to grow my payas.
Okay, so that brought up an idea, which is if you follow a certain movement, you kind of focus on that movement and you cut yourself off from other groups, which he is opposed to based on his library of Hasidic books. What does he say to the argument that conservative Jews point to Orthodoxy and say they cut themselves off from others?
You know, they tell a story about this older couple that's on the freeway. They're married 40 years, and husband's driving the car and his wife's sitting on the passenger side, And she says, Frank? He says, I don't know what's happened to us. You know, when we were young, when we were teenagers, you know, we'd sit in the car together and we were so close. We were just right up next to each other. And look at us now. Look how much distance there is between the two of us. And Frank goes right on steering the car, sitting in the seat, and he says, Sally, dear, it's not me who's moved. There may be differences in the distance between the movements, but it's not us who's moved. We're not the ones who've moved. If the rest of the Jewish world has decided that Kashrut doesn't matter, that the Torah can be in large parts abandoned or compromised or deconstructed or vetted to their satisfaction, they're the ones who made the move. And it's tragic. And again, I don't mean to be glib about it. It hurts me. It doesn't just hurt them. But the solution is not going to be for us to compromise on the truths of Torah that kept us as a people for the last 3,300 years and are making Orthodoxy the only denomination today that's viable for the future. Is Orthodoxy afraid of change? At times it is. At times it is. First of all, there's some kind of change, which is just out of the question. We are part of a legal system that deals with defining which elements are changeable and which elements are not. So most of the things that the other movements would like us to change are inviolate and can't be compromised. No, we can't change the laws of conversion to look the other way and allow for reform and conservative conversion. They just don't have any validity according to halakha. Are there things that could change? Are Hasidim afraid of change by not shedding garb that was picked up in 17th century Poland? You bet, and for good reason. And for good reason. Externals, garb, language, cultural props are all very important in creating a mood, an environment in which you can more effectively conduct the business of your Judaism, raise your children, stave off the intrusions of an increasingly intrusive secular culture outside. There may be better reason today to look for such props than ever before. I wish I knew ones that would succeed. Maybe I would become a Hasid also. I don't think that they're terribly effective. I don't think you can build walls high enough to keep out that world. I think you have to come up with other tools. But I don't claim to have the last say in that. Sure, people are afraid of change. They're afraid that if you change things, that people will want more change. And what the initial change may be innocuous, the next round of change may be more severe. Not everyone is a deeply analytic thinker. The masses don't always understand the subtlety. It's part of recognized halachic procedure. Many, many examples in the Talmud of trying to understand where the community is and sometimes putting up fences, even where that's not what the law demands, in order to make sure that the standards are not compromised. There's a conservatism within Orthodoxy, the idea that change often is pushed, sometimes for reasons that are ephemeral and don't last very long. And there's a German proverb that he who is married to the latest trend quickly becomes a widow. So we have safeguards about changing too quickly. It can mean that sometimes we change not quickly enough. We're human. God gave us that revelation once at Sinai. He doesn't promise that he's going to send the hand down from heaven every 25 years with the latest revision. So a lot of what we do is his instructions of how we're supposed to deal with it. We are human beings. I think that we have the best system out there. But we make mistakes at times. So to sum up, I think there's good reason to be afraid of change. There are some changes that that should be made at times, especially changes in attitude, things that are part and parcel of a lifestyle in Europe that no longer obtains in a modern democracy. And those changes will come. Sometimes it's frustrating that they don't come more quickly, but it's not halakha that should change.
I wondered if they teach non-Orthodox philosophy in their Orthodox schools.
And we have a modern Orthodox high school, and at least in the girls' school, I know that they do spend time examining the beliefs of the other denominations.
Wow, that's interesting. And so they.
I think it makes them stronger.
They're not afraid of it.
They're not afraid of it. If we wouldn't understand it so well, it would be inexplicable about how people can look at certain extremes or extreme figures or extreme activity and say, aha, there's the reason why I'm not more observant, and look away from all of the counter examples. But when people have a need to be able to reject, and they're torn, on the one hand, part of them knows that they really should be observant, and part of them says, I don't want to give up my freedom. So you look to find reasons why you can't make that jump.
Speaking of observance, I ask him whether we should be making heroes out of Jews who do something Jewish in the public eye, such as Sandy Koufax taking off from the World Series on Yom Kippur, but he would work every Shabbat, every Sabbath. Was that an achievement?
Well, for Sandy Koufax, it was an achievement. For somebody who's brought up with more of a sense of Jewish identity and observance, taking off one day would be nothing to write home to mom about at all. What is important is for people to realize that every mitzvah counts. Every mitzvah is a step in the right direction. Every mitzvah brings you closer to God. It's not an all-or-nothing proposition, as so many people outside of Orthodoxy think, that you can only be Orthodox if you're perfect in every way. That's what Orthodoxy is about. And if you can't go the whole way, it doesn't pay. Precisely because Judaism is so demanding, it can't work if perfection is where you have to be at, and it's simply not true. All of us are sinners. I hate to sound like a Christian, but we are. You know, we all make mistakes, and we have our up days and our down days, and there are temptations and a thousand different ones a day. Every mitzvah gets you closer, gets your soul closer to where it could be, and every transgression takes you a little further away. But nothing can undo the beauty of a single mitzvah. So for every person where they are, every mitzvah is something positive.
Thank you once again to Rabbi Adlerstein. He is a phenomenal interviewee. Very, very direct and open, and I appreciated that. We have one more part coming up. I want to remind you that we have a website, whyjudaism.org, whyjudaism.org, and we want you to subscribe to this podcast and follow us and share it, and also take advantage of our sponsor, hazaka.com. That's hazakah.com. Jewish games that feed the brain. See you next time.
All right, that's it. Hot as hell, Jay.